accession number 20940, reel 5.
Roger Scott, reel 5.
Right. Took the ammunition out of Dixie Dean. Went over to the kits of the other people that were wounded and took the ammunition out of their kit. And this is where I found out that Paddy Arnott, he had nothing in his small pack. Instead of water bottle, mess tins and things like that he should have had in it, it was full of fags. He stuffed his pack full of fags. I don't know if he thought he was going to run short of them or what. Anyway, that helped the boys. They got distributed, right? And then I went back and I was in this position with Jackie Barnes or Johnny Barnes. And we stayed like that, doing hour about. And the end of the day came. We had 24-hour ration pack combo. And everybody made a brew up or made something to eat or drink. And a lot of people scoff at this combo, but it's good stuff if you know how to use it right. Right? If you ain't got the bloody patience to use it right, you can starve. But I mean, most people being sensible, they got a set of mess tins and they got a bloody combo pack, they can make a decent meal. Right? And I'll say that against anybody, especially nowadays with the ball in the bag here, you know. But that day, it was all rudimentary. Tea block with milk, sugar and tea in a block. I should give that away. I'd give it anybody who wanted it. I'd say, give us your Oxo cubes, or I'll make a beef tea. Which to me was a bleeding sort of better than that tea, anyway. But anyway, you could make some decent tucker out of it, right? We stayed the first night in that ditch, the morning after. Nobody walks about. You don't need anybody to come around and say, stand to, because first light, if you're a trained soldier, you know what it means. And in that hedgerow, there's about 40 of us left in that hedgerow from the day before. Now, 40 blokes out of 75. Now, let's take it from the top. Three officers, we lost two. Sergeant Major, 100% gone, he was dead. Four sergeants, we lost three. And out of 75 blokes, we had 40 of us left. Right? Anyway, the morning after, everybody was watching their front. Nothing happened. Everybody said, well, you know, get your heads down. Someone stay on watch, but get your heads down and have a brew on, or do, you know, get a bit of breakfast up. And then, as it got lighter, so it started, didn't it? The normal German tactic. You was in your hedgerow, all of a sudden, smack. Round went into the tree. Bang, another one went into the bleed, and bang, up there. Wallop, one shot through the, you know. They were sniping you, or just firing rounds into where they knew you were, but they didn't know exactly where you were. They knew you was in that area, but they was trying to find you. All they wanted you to do was fire back. Nobody did. Like I said, commando soldiers, not silly. So nobody, and then the next thing that happened, Ponsford comes out to me and says, Scott, get your brain gun. So that was that. I went and got my brain gun back. A bloke called Parker had it. When I got it, all Parker. Not only that, I got the gun, I got my 4.5 back as well. And then on the right-hand side, like, then we had a brain gun. We had some captured German weapons. We had captured German hand grenades, plus our own British gear. And that's how the 7th of June started. And we just went through the day like that. Anyway, things developed. Next thing, we found a dead airborne officer in the hedgerow, because we decided to have a look at our immediate vicinity. You don't know what's there. And we found this geezer laying there, dead. The back of his leg was blown away, behind his knee. And I forget, I think it was a major, but he had his large pack was there, it was open. He tried to do something for himself, but he had his wallet out with a photo of his missus, and I think it was two kids. And he must have been looking at him when he died. Because I don't know to this day, but maybe if we'd have looked the minute we got there, he might have still been alive. And he might not have said anything or called out because he didn't know who we were. You see what I mean? It's one of them things. See, I mean, that's how it happened. Anyway, someone, without telling us on the right, decided to get rid of him. And they pushed him out in front of the position, which was wrong. They pushed him out in front of the position. He was just laying there. Anyway, come the night of the 7th, right? I'm on watch, and I can hear this perpetual rustling and movement to me left. Oh, what the shot in hell's that? So I wake up Johnny, and I'll tell him. And we go and have a look. Well, not far, I just put myself through the edge and looked. And I could see this body laying there like that. I went, in the dark, you know, is that someone calling? They didn't tell me that they'd pushed the body out. Oh, Johnny, when I got hold of Jimmy Sinnott. And Jimmy Sinnott, he was in oil for a long time. And he's got his own boat and all that out in the Med. And I'll tell you what, we used to think sometimes he's a little bit unhinged because Jimmy, mate, he wasn't cold, you know what I mean? He was a good lad. And he said, right, one of you there, cover me, watch that, cover me. And he went out like that and come in like that. And we found him, it was his dead body. Anyway, I don't know who moved him, someone took him away, but I mean, that was that. But that alarm was over. And the day after, the June the 8th morning, until then, like, nothing had happened, sort of thing. They'd been tatting, they'd been trying to find us, and they'd been shelling and mortaring us and all that, like, that area. They knew we was in that area somewhere, but they don't know where. Anyway, what happened to that? 4 and 5 troop went down to finish off the job in the Merville Battery, which 9 para only shut down for a little while, and it got reactivated. So 4 and 5 went down and finished the job for them. We lost Pooley doing it, he got killed, and that, so that day it was more people begin to feel it, like, you know, I don't care who you are and what training you've done, you was up June the 5th, the night of the 5th, you was up all day 6, weren't you, day going it, you get there the 7th, and until then, now you're getting into 3 days where you had no proper food, no proper sleep, and you know, well, and then it started, didn't it? Over it come. Get your heads down. And then I all got my head down, and Johnny Barnes is saying, have a look. I'm going, no, you have a look. He said, there might be a couple. I said, nah, not while they're shelling, they're not going to come in. He said, have a look. I said, no, you have a look. Go on, have a look. He said, I'll tell you what, we both have a look. See, this is the sort of thing. So, anyway. We have a butcher's. Now, in front of us was a cabbage field. It was all cabbages. Right? And about 75 metres, 100 metres maybe maximum, was a hedgerow. Beyond the hedgerow was an orchard. And we looked. We didn't look for long, right? Just a quick peek. Nothing was happening. Down again. And then the fire lengthened. It went away from our hedgerow, over our heads onto the road, which was behind us, and the wall of the chateau. So we looked. From behind the hedgerow, which was giving them cover, they was coming down through the orchard and lying in the back of the hedgerow. See? Where have I seen this before? With the 70th bloody Suffolk, you know, with the Black Watch. Anyway, these are coming down in ones and twos behind it, through the orchard, behind the hedgerow. So now we've got 75 metres, 100 metres maybe between us and them. Then the word comes down the line, doesn't it? No firing until the blast of the whistle. None of these fancy number one group, 500, and all this, you know, like you're taught at infantry training school, fire orders and all that. You can see your targets in front of you. You're not going to fight the geezer over there, you fight the geezer there, in front of you. You know. Anyway, nobody does nothing. We're just all watching our front. All the weapons are ready. I mean, you see these silly sods trying to line up behind this hedgerow. I mean, you know, all of a sudden they're coming through the hedgerow. You know, I thought we were silly in the army, but they're not much more clever. I suppose they're doing as ordered anyway. They're coming through the hedgerow. And they're forming a sort of ragged skirmish line. Then they're coming on through the cabbages. And me, like anybody else, I'm on this thing. You got to blow that bleeding whistle, you know. And Ponsford, he let him get about halfway across the field. He blows his whistle. All hell let loose. There was no question of, you know, loading up and what. You just find a weapon, it was empty, chuck it down and pick up another one, have a go with it, good, you know. Doesn't matter if it was German or British. And that was it. And within what? I don't know. It sounded like bloody lifetime, but it's a couple of minutes. All gone. Those that wasn't down, they were dead. If they were really clever, mate, they were down anyway. You know, get out of the bloody way. Some tried to run back. Too bad. But then we were looking at a field, weren't we, of busted up cabbages and bodies. So that night, the word come round. We're going out there and we're going to knock all the bleeding cabbages down. And they got no cover then. You know. So that's what we done. We went out there in the night and ruined these field of cabbages for the farmer. I mean, hard luck, son, but there it was. And do you know what? They never tried that full on again. They tried to come down the road on our left. They tried to come down on the right. But whether they come through the wall position along the road or to the right, or if they come tried to come through us, they got the same answer. They never got through our lines. Never got through Fleet Commando's lines, mate. And if they went through the orchard on the right at the farm where Sixth Commando was, they never got through there either. You know? The only place you had a slight success was at Salinelles. And they pushed 4 or 5 Commando back a little bit. And we got a report through that Germans could be coming up the Salinelles Road, but they didn't, because 4 or 5 took them back again. I don't think on that left flank, as far as number one Special Service Brigade was concerned, and we was attached to 6th Airborne Div, I don't think they never got any back. What we took on the first day, we kept. They tried it. It was bad. Some days, most of the attacks would be mortar and shell fire. Then you get a company. I think in one day they tried it with a full, complete battalion of infantry, which is about 750 blokes, along the whole front, you know. But they never got anywhere. Never got anywhere. Anyway, we held that edge row for some people say it was a week. Seemed like longer to me, but anyway. It come up one day that you're going to get relieved. We did, in a way, because one morning, a Branco, you know, a Lloyd carrier, a track vehicle, come up, and another one behind it, and they stopped on the road behind us on the bend, and it belonged to the Island Division, the Highway Decorators, as we called them. You know why they called them the Highway Decorators, don't you? They put their signs up all over the shop. Island Division, 51st Island Division, the Highway Decorators, HD. Anyway, they've pulled up with these bleeding carriers, offloaded a couple of mortars, right? And we're sort of sitting there because we've got the edge rail on and we're sitting there looking at the road watching these people sitting on the mortars on the side of the road. Out comes the ammunition and we thought, no, you're not going to do that, you know? And away they've gone, pum, 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 you know? All over there, out going Mel, straight down to Jerry. And we thought, oh yeah, go on. Next thing they done, dismantled their mortars, back in the carriers, woof, they're away. What did we say? Get your heads down. What's Jerry going to do? He's going to answer, isn't he? And he did. Smashed the place, didn't he? You know? And we thought, well, thank you very much. If that's the island, if, you know. Anyway, they were there. We knew they were there. They'd come ashore about D4 or something. But one of the results of one of the shellings, one of our blokes had dug his slit trench alongside a wall. And a shell hit the wall, and he got a lot of it down his back. And he happened to be the mate. I don't know if his name was Anderson or something like that. He happened to be Big Bill Garrett's mate. Big Bill was a copper. He'd come into commando for the police draft. And he was Big Bill's bloody mate. And when he got hit, someone yelled out, stretcher bearers, like, you know. And we were getting shelled. We'd under shell fire. And Big Bill's got down there with a stretcher, because I think Big Bill was having to do with the first aid and Ned Moore and the doctor and all that, you know. But he got down there, and him and another geezer got him out of the hole onto the stretcher. And the only way to get to the chateau, or the first aid place, was to come down the edge row, down the other edge row, across the T-junction, right, and then into the first aid centre. I think it was still in the post office. But anyway, he's come down the edge row, because all the time it's crash bang wallop all around us. He's come down, he's got to the corner where we are with Johnny Barnes and myself is, and it was a bit thick, because you know, all these things in a film, like you hear a shell coming over, like, you know, you don't. If it's near you, you don't hear it. It's just a, you know, it's gone. Anyway, that's what happened just as you got the corner behind us. It was a question of that, you know, get down of it. And they've dived, don't they? But the thing was this, when they got up, the bloke on the stretcher fell off the stretcher. They picked him up and dumped him back on the stretcher. And down they've gone with him. And Big Bill Barrett screaming his bleeding head off, ain't he? Run, 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 get him down. You've got all this lot. And they've gone. The only point was, I think the bloke was dead already. Because he's left a lot of his bloody body work behind us. He's still laying there when they picked him up. Yeah. Big Bill was always demented. I don't know. Anyway, after a few days, like I said, it might have been a week or something, they said, you're getting relieved. And our hedgerow was a complete shambles. It was beginning to look something like 14, 18, you know what I mean? And, I mean, everything was ready. And we did get relieved. We got relieved by our own fife troop. They said a jockman was coming up to relieve us, but they changed their minds. And fife troop, one of our fife troop come in and changed over with us. There was 30 of us left, all ranks. And actually in the records, they don't stay of ranks or whatever. It was just 30 blokes all told. That was three troop, what was left of it. And they moved us back into the grounds, into the orchard behind the Chateau d'Amfreville. And, we got into this orchard and there was a big, long German trench there. And what they said to us was, improve the trench, put head cover on it, and tonight you're going to have a night's sleep. So we worked at the old trench there, put cover on it, made it as comfortable as we could, had a decent meal, and I think someone nicked a bleeding calf. And one of our blokes, Spencer, was a German Jew, 10 come on though, 10 ex troop, 10. He was a butcher. I and Johnny Barnes, between them, they strung it up, killed it, strung it up, gutted it, and we had fresh meat that night. Good. And a night's sleep. The morning after, everybody was up, and everybody had to get to the, there's a pond. We went all down a pond. I mean, there's only about 500 yards behind the line, but I mean, everybody had a wash and shave, clean up, a good breakfast and that. We got a cookhouse working, and that was that. The morning was spent like that on what you might call interior economy, they call it in the army, clean up, make a mend in the Navy, anyway. Then, the afternoon come the crunch, didn't it? From that time on, every night, you was out patrolling, raiding, you know, either reconnaissance patrol, fighting patrol, you know, whatever, and someone has spot a target, we go down and do it, you know, this is what you're going to do tonight, and you'll be briefed and all that, and you come back in the morning. But every night, one bloke had to stay behind. We had a kid called Whitey, and on D-Day, he'd come along the wall where the machine gun was at the end of the track, and I'll see this happen. He came along the wall, just as the bleeding 88 at the top of the wall. It was down there, like, you know, and the top of the wall there was taken off by this 88 shell. But the concussion of it, the blast, sent him bloody bomb happy, you know. And, sent him bomb happy. And he was still with us. They put him in what they called the Todd organisation. That was burying the dead. So every night when they went out on a job, someone had to stay with Whitey, and this particular night, it was me, right? And what we got a slit trench along the wall of the chateau, and we collapsed part of the wall over the slit trench to make a roof. So you could only get in, there was only a little place to get in. Once you got in, we had a German MG-42 we used to put in the hole, facing straight down the track that went to Holger, right? That's the only way anybody can come in that position, that way. The other side was guarded by somebody else. But every night you got what we got, the nightly hate, the nightly stonk. Right, Ponsford and the others are gone out. I'm on me Jack Jones with bloody Whitey in his hole. And he's like that, isn't he? You know, and he's bang, you know, and It's terrible, see a bloke like that. Anyway, I'll sit with him and he'll, well, she says, oh, not bloody thirsty. I'll move the gun out of the way. I said, go and find something to drink. Well, I thought he'd come back with a bottle of cider or something. But he come back, he didn't tell me. He come back, he got a bottle of bleak Calvados. You ever drunk Calvados?
Yeah.
The naked stuff, I mean, what they make themselves. And he come back, he got in the hole, put the gun back. He always says, I went, thanks. Pull the cork out. Blah, 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 blah. God. Jesus. And that was the start of the evening. Anyway, later on, the inevitable happened, didn't it? He started his nightly hate. Crash, bang, wallop, all around the position and everywhere. And Whitey's gone spare. He went absolutely berserk. I couldn't hold him. And he pushed the gun out of the way and he's gone. He ran straight down the track into the woods, there's a small wood there, straight into the woods. And that's the last I'll see of him. He ran into the woods, there was a salvo exploding in the trees and that, you know. And I thought, Christ, that must have got him. Because the morning after, I spent the rest of the night in and out of that hole. I was getting in, I was getting out of the slash and all that, you know. But couldn't find why. I was on my jack. That was it. And in the morning, they've come back. And I told Ponsford I should start doing the night. He went, I couldn't hold him. I just couldn't hold him. He said, oh, well, we done what we could. Anyway, three days later, Ponsford went into the woods, which by now is all fallen branches and cut up trees, you know, you can imagine it. And further into the wood was the continuation of this German trench that we was in, right? Because it stopped at one place, but the next one, a bit further on, it went on again. And Ponsford decided, he's going to have a look in there, you know, so he did. He went, and part of it was covered, right? And this trench went all the way to Hooger, where four commando were, in the woods, on that edge of the wood. But it was in sections, right? So anyway, Ponsford's gone out there, idle curiosity, I suppose, and he decided, I'm going to have a look down there, see what's down there. And he did. He's got right up the black end of it, up the dead end, and he found a body. Who was it? Whitey. Bunched up like a dead rabbit, and he couldn't get him out. He wouldn't come out. He was there, and that's where he wanted to stay. And, you know, since the night I lost him, right, to then, he hadn't had anything to eat or drink. And the kid was gone. He was absolutely, you know, shattered. And he come back and he got hold of a couple of the guardsmen, blokes, the big boys. And they went in there with him. They literally dragged him out. And they took him into commando headquarters. And there was Ned Moore, our doctor. He was a good doctor, a good bloke, old Ned. And he couldn't do a thing for him. He just had to sedate him and send him out of it, get him out. Because that kid had gone, mate. It's the worst case I've ever seen. He was gone. Yeah. But incidents there. But they're all looking for the wine cellar in the shallow. Couldn't find it. But I found an outhouse in the woods. It was a cider press. You ever seen a cider press? Massive.
I think so.
With a big screw, you know, whatever. And I went in there and I thought, oh, Christ. And then I see a little room in the corner with a padlock on the door. So I smashed the padlock off and opened the door. It was only a little door. You had to bend down to get in. It was the Chateau's wine cellar. All pigeonholes, all the wine, all the bottles. Jeez, I thought, look at this. Well, when I told the lads, complete waste. I was taking a bottle, smashing a bottle. I done all that one. I mean, complete waste. It's a typical bloody, you know. God knows how much it was worth then. But anyway, it didn't last long. But we found a big vat of cider. We had a 50 cigarette tin, a round tin, as a drinking vessel. We should leave that there and go down the cider vat and have a bevy of cider, good cider, you know. That was all right. But incidents, whilst we was at that place, we had certain people from the number 10 X Troop, number 10 Commando X Troop people, they're German Jews, as you know. Especially one, Lawrence, his English name was. And the other one was Spencer. And we had a bloke called Bartlett as well. Now, I did a couple of jobs with both of them, but the one that impressed me the most was Spencer. I have never seen anybody. Do you know what? If I see him today, the first thing I'd do is kiss him and shake his hand and all that. But I wouldn't alter my opinion. As a cold-blooded somebody, he's got to be it. Now, we went out one night on a patrol with him, and he was our interpreter, what you call it. Right? And we got right forward, and the Gunnerville Road used to go from this Gunnerville through Gunnerville up in the back of Breville and that. That was the German front line. Before the front line, he had outposts. Right, that was between the Grand Ferme de Bisson and the road. Over the left there was the Merville Battery, which was still occupied by the Germans. No guns. Right. And as we found out later, the guns had never been in there, the real guns. They were in front of a wood over the other side of the Gunnerville Road. We found them. Anyway, we've gone down this road, and Spencer, he said, right, one, two, and three, we get down. No talking. Down. Watch. Come on. He took Ted Pritchard, Welsh Guardsman, and myself, and we walked up the side of the road. We didn't creep, just walked. Because I was wearing SV boots, rubber sole boots, you know, the school and sole, the old commando boot. I was wearing them. We're on the side of the road. Just walk normal. If you start crouching and slouching, right, they see you, there's something. You know, when you walk normally in your own place, you walk normal, don't you? Say you walk normal, don't you? We walk on the road. And all of a sudden, we can hear. Not much, but just enough. You know, someone down there snuffling. Anyway, Pritchard got one side, I got the other. We bent down, we got hold of this bloke, and we just, boom, bodily out of the bleed now. And he stood there. And Spencer had pushed the muzzle of his bloody Thompson into his guts. And he says, stump, to be scafanger, you know, keep quiet, the prisoner. And this bloke, he must have thought that his mates were playing a joke. Because on one side of him like that, Pritchard's the other, we're holding him, we still got hold of him. And Spencer says that, and this bloke went, ah, do be, you know, he's talking about, you're a bloody fool, I don't play about. Now, most of us carried our knives there. Right?
On your thigh.
On there. On a special attachment at the trousers. Some put a little pocket inside, you know. Anyway, he's pushed the bloody Thompson away. And Spencer went, oh, I'm not playing about. Straight in. And this bloke just collapsed. We let him go in the hole, didn't we? Down. Along the road. Found another one. But this one was sensible. We grabbed him and pulled him out, you know. He didn't need telling. He took one look, mate. He knew we'd got hold of him, and he was gone. That was that. So Spencer said, right, pick up your gear. And he had him pick up all his gear that was around his rifle. That's it. Come. Back down the road. Pick up all his gear. Right? Pick up all the other German gear, rifle and all that. He said, right, pull him out. Pull the body out. He said, put across his shoulder and put a dead body across the other bloke's shoulders. He's got two lots of kit, two rifles and a dead body across his shoulders. And we walked out. And we walked out, picked up the other three, out. Got back to the Grand Ferme de Bisson, which is our raiding base. Dumped the body. And that. And made our way back to Amphreville, along the back lane. But I said to Spencer afterwards, I said, Christ, was that necessary? He said, well, the next thing that bloke would have done was started shouting. We'd have all been up the creek. He said, you can't leave them behind because they know we've been then. I said, they're going to know we've been anyway. So he said, no, all they're going to find is two empty holes. They won't be sure. There'd be doubt. He said, because if you'd left their rifles and all their kit behind, they'll know that the people are gone and that we've got them, like, you know. But he said, the other one would be doubtful. But anyway, that was Spencer. That was Spencer, the sort of thing he'd do. And the other one, Lawrence, used to walk out, he'd go out to the Grand Ferme de Bisson, he'd walk out across the cornfield with a bloke, drop the bloke off, say, wait for me here. He only wanted him as a sort of mind, eh?